It's with transient, which I've been working on in the last 6 years in preparation with all the focus here. So I will first start with the broad feature of the main properties of thermal which is black holes, and the status of the interaction between these two jets. It will be very partial and very broad introduction to this. And then I will focus on KB-UMA, which is a source where we believe we see signature of interaction between the accretion processes and ejection processes on a short time scale, less than a second. Then I will present a funny model to explain these observations. And then I will discuss some of the consequences, more general consequences of these observations and models. So, black hole binaries are observed in many different spectral states. But there are two main spectral states. The first one is the one shown here in blue, which is called high source state. This state is observed at high luminosity, when the sources have luminosities above a few percent of any dot. And in this state, the peak of the luminosity is like around a few keV's. And the spectrum is dominated by this thermal component that is believed to come from the accretion disk, from the inner part of the accretion disk. And then at higher energies, you have this power law, non-thermal components, that extends at least up to 800 keV's, which could come from a non-thermal corona above the accretion disk or possibly also non-thermal corona. And then when the source is in at lower luminosity, below this few percent of the equal luminosity, then we see this kind of spectra. And then the peak of the luminosity is at about 100 keV's. And the spectrum is much harder. And this kind of spectra are generally interpreted as being due to the thermal quantization, a soft photon, scattered by hot electrons in the plasma, which temperatures can reach the 1 billion degrees. And this is called the low hard state because it is low in the X-rays and the power.
Excuse me, is it alright to interact with the silicon?
Sure.
Yes?
Sure.
Okay. I mystified by the name soft and hard. Can you explain why it's called
soft means that the spectrum is steep.
And yeah, why soft? Why not steep?
Because speed depends on how you count spectral indices. Soft, I think the right definition for soft is that in whatever energy range you observe, the energy comes out at the low energy end of your photons. Whereas a hard spectrum is one where the energy comes at the high energy end.
All right.
But why hard and soft?
It's soft photons and hard photons.
High energy and low.
Yeah. Well, that's what. Yeah. It's hard to soft is easier, you know, it's just more colloquial.
Okay. In traditional way of black hole. Now, these different states are interpreted by changes in the geometry of the accretion. So in high source state, you have the standard geometrically synopticalistic accretion disk that extends down to the last stable orbit. And we have a weak non-thermal corona in the inner part of the accretion disk. And you see thermal emission mainly. While in the hot states, the standard thin disk will be truncated at some distances from the ball, typically 200 of gravitational radii. And in the innermost part, you will have a geometrically thick and optically thin accretion flow that could be related to solution of Shapiro-Rathman only or to the adhesion-dominated solution of accretion flows. And this is in this part of the flow that the quantization process will take place. There is an alternative model in which the thin disk extends down to the last stable orbit, but in the innermost part of the accretion flow, it is not radiated, it does not radiate its energy, because all the power is taken into a hot corona above and below the disk and then radiated in the form of flares, that are comparable to what happens in the solar corona. But in both cases, you have a hot plasma which produces high energy photons. Now, what about the jets? There is strong evidence that all sources in the hot state and at low luminosity have a compact radio jets, heavy jets. So these kind of jets have been resolved with radio observation in some sources like Cygnus 6-1, and it extends typically on the scale of one or more astronomical units. And in other sources where it has not been possible to resolve the structure, you still have the radio spectrum, which is typically flat and similar to the spectrum of Cygnus 6-1 and the other sources where you can see the jets. And that is very well interpreted by self-absorbed synchrotron jet models. So these are flat or inverted spectra produced by jets. So it seems that everywhere you look at, every time you have a source in the hot state, you look in the radio and you see these things as the signature of the jet. Now, what's interesting is that when the source switches to the soft state, this jet seems to disappear. For instance, here you have a famous case which is H59-4, which was followed in the radio, in the hard X-ray photon, and the soft X-ray photons during an outburst. So at the beginning, you have a low flux in the soft X-ray, strong flux in the hard X-ray, in the hard state, and you have the strong radio emissions. And then suddenly, you switch it to a softer state with strong X-ray emission and weak hard X-ray emission, and you see that at the same time, the radio emission fades and falls below the detection limits. Then at the end, the source goes back to the hard state and the radio comes back again. So there is evidence that the jet disappears in the soft state.
What is the time scale?
Yeah, is it second?
Oh no, it's days.
Days is 400 days.
It's a true
days. Yes, days.
Okay.
So this lasted for 400 days. What is also interesting is that there is an interesting correlation between the X-ray emission and the radio emission. X-ray emission that comes from, believed to come from the disk, and radio emission from the jets. And this is the dot here represents the data for about 10 black hole binaries. And you see that you have a correlation between the X-ray flux and the radio flux that is valid for about 1, 2, 3, 4 order of magnitude in luminosity. Until the sources reach luminosity of order of a few percent of Eddington, and then the source switch to the soft state, and then the radio emission disappears. So you have this correlation. And one of the possible interesting consequences of this correlation is that in the possibility of the existence of a jet-dominated regime at low mass accretion rates. So this was derived by Kendall Gallo and John Kerr in 2003. It's a very simple argument that we have the correlation between the radio luminosity and the X-ray power of the source, and this is the analysis that is taken directly from the observations. Then you use simple synchrotron formulae for the jet emissions, that assume simply that the jet is self-similar. And in fact, and this formula is derived by I don't remember, sorry, but recently derived, gives the result that the radio emission should scale as the jet power to the 1.4. And from these two you derive that the jet power scale like the X-ray power, the square root of the X-ray power. And then if you assume that that the only energy output of the system are X-ray for jets, then you find the relationship between the mass accretion rate and the jet power of the X-ray power.
So So if you believe this, what you find is that there is a critical accretion rate below which the jet power scale like m dot and the x-ray power rate like m dot square, and the jet power is larger by up to a few order of magnitude than the x-ray power. And it is interesting to see that the x-ray, the source is relatively inefficient due to this scale. And above this critical mass accretion rate, the x-ray dominates and you have a relatively efficient regime.
Or it's consistent with being radiatively efficient.
Sorry?
It's consistent with being radiatively efficient. We don't know that.
No, it has to be radiatively inefficient because most of the power is in the jet, so...
The jet power comes from these typical inversions of radio spectra. Or how do you characterize the jet power?
You use a formula, a simple formula that relates the radio luminosity that you observe to the jet power. And then from the observation you know that the radio luminosity stays like this with the X-ray luminosity.
Yeah.
And then you get this. And the assumption here is that there is no strong advection or no other thing for the system.
But in this scaling radio with power of the jet, there's a number of assumptions in there, isn't there? And this is the most assumption.
The only assumption here is that the jet is subsimilar. They use the subsimilarities and an argument to derive this
scale. But you also need to tell whether it's baryons or electrons. You need to assume like equation and things like that. Isn't that what you have
to do? I don't think so.
You have no independent estimate of the jet power except
it's not an estimate of the jet power. It's a scaling.
Yeah, but normalize the
but at the moment no. It is not normalized. The model does not give the normalization concept here. So just a scaling, if you assume for example the mass accretion rate, scaling with mass accretion rate.
Yeah, but
in the figure, here you have a constant that appears, and indeed, you have to determine what is this constant to normalize this.
Yeah.
And this constant will fix this critical accretion rate, where you have the change in the two regimes. And this constant is a free parameter, but it can be estimated, it depends on the jet, the ratio of the jet to X-ray power. So if you could measure this in one source, then we could fix this constant. Here, what they did is that they used very conservative estimates to fix this constant. So actually, this is a lower limit on the critical accretion rate. So if you could move this line this way, but not the other way. So in any case, there is some, if you believe this argument, there is some kind of dominated regime at some point. But here they have it's a very low accretion rate, so there are very few observations in this region, so it is very difficult to test.
What's the gray? The
gray
band?
The range... I don't know. Sorry, I don't know.
It is
not specified here. I will find, if you like, I will find the paper by it's the answer to my paper.
Okay.
So. By the way, when J power goes up, when radio luminosity goes up even higher, right? At some point they will be equal. Where will happen?
If
that's what this figure shows.
Okay. Go on.
No.
No.
No. I mean, the point is that all this, this cannot be universal, right? Because the radio luminosity must be the minimum of the jet power. Right?
It must be what?
Well, the radio luminosity has to be less than the total power of the jet. Right?
Yes, yes. So, no, this, yeah, this is... This is...
So he is tiny.
Yeah, okay, but here it's okay, yes, it's less than the radio power. But this relationship, I mean this one.
Yes.
So the radio luminosity is always much less than the radio
yes.
power?
Yes, yes.
And where does all the power go?
Kinetic energy.
In adiabatic expansion or...
So okay. It doesn't hit anything on the radio.
No. Not in this model.
Right.
Okay. So now the question was then to.
Well, I think you're taking the radio luminosity at the central source. So there's there's material flowing outside.
Yeah. You look at the core luminosity. So. Now the question is to try to understand why you have this kind of correlation. So when all these observations were published, then people immediately say, okay, well, all the corona model for the hot set are wrong, and probably what we see in the hard X-rays is actually the due to the jets. So they developed jets model for the hard X-rays. But then, when comparing to the detailed observation to trying to fit the spectra, we all realize that this kind of model, you need to put the X-ray emission very close to the disk in order to have not too much binning, to reproduce the reprocessing feature that are observed in the X-ray spectra and so on. So in the end, this model becomes very similar to corona because we have the X-ray emission region close to the disk. So then it's more a matter of terminology to say if the X-ray emission is the base of the jet or corona, but more or less the picture, the cartoon picture are the same. But what is clear is that the hot compromising region is intrinsically associated with the production and the launching of these compact radio jets.
I'm sorry, this is a dumb question. So you're saying that it's the detection of reflection features that force you to put the X-ray machine close to the...
Yes.
But we're talking about the low power state, right?
Yes. There.
You still see reflection features?
Sure. I'm seeing a 6-1 person.
Okay.
There are also arguments.
I mean, this is clear in the beginning, this entire jet sideline instead of it was completely unnecessary. I mean, if you just look at the data, in the beginning, no point in doing this.
So the point is that the X-rays are, you don't have to count the X-rays coming from the jet.
So the base now the debate is how much the X-ray from the jet contributes to the X-ray emission of UC, but seems that in most sources you are not dominated by the jet. So to explain this association between jet and hot accretion flow, there was one interesting suggestion that was made, is that since if you consider NHT jets, since they are driven by the peripheral component of the magnetic field, and if the field is generated by some kind of dynamo in the disk, then there is a limitation on the strength of the ferrodynamic field that is due to the it is limited by the scale height of the flow. And then in this case, geometrically sick flow should be more efficient at launching jets than geometrically thin ones. So I don't know, it's only a suggestion. I would like to see a simulation of this kind of thing. I haven't seen this before. Okay, so now I will focus on the source KV Yuma, that is actually better known as by its astronomers as J1118, but Hank thinks that KV Yuma sounds better, so it's why I
changed all my surname. But of course, XDJ1118 plus 480 or something is more technical.
So this is a black hole binary in a low mass binary system. So the mass function was determined, and it suggests the presence of a compact object of at least 6 solar masses. And it was discovered at the Higgs nova, which was discovered in 2000 when it went into an outburst. You have here the profile of the Higgs light curve that we have seen for a few months. And this source, it was attracted a lot of attention because of its location out of the galactic plane and very close to us, with a very low extension along the line of sight, which enabled the people to observe this source with an unprecedented wavelength coverage, going from the radio, where you have the nice jet spectrum, to the hard X-ray, where you see a typical hard state spectrum. And in between, there is this thermal component that is believed to be accretion disk. And what is interesting here is that this is the temperature, the inner disk temperature is inferred to be very low, a few tens EVs. That means that the disk has to be truncated at some distances, and we infer the distance of a few hundred, between 100 and 300 structural radii from the black hole. And this black curve shows the accretion disk model if the disk was to go to the last stable orbit. And it is clearly inconsistent with the data. So either the disk is truncated at some distances from the disk, either it is not, it does not radiate in the inner part of the accretion disk. Okay? So now I will focus on the timing property of the source using the EC data and optical data, taken with the fast optical photometer Optima, the photometer with the millisecond resolution.
Microsecond.
Sorry? Microsecond. Microsecond, but in the data I had it was 2 milliseconds.
Yeah,
they're
not enough
photos. Because what was very striking in this source is that not only you have a strong X-ray flickering on time scale of seconds or less, but you also have optical flickering with an amplitude of about 10%. And this is very, this was observed only in one source before 20 years ago. So the upper line is the optical light curve, and the lower line is the X-ray light curve, simultaneous.
Or these are just different.
The different samples.
Is the scale the same? The really counts and optical counts. And
yes, yes, yeah, exactly.
That's your money.
Well, it could split up. Right?
So these are HST data. And you see this featuring in optical from the UV down to the infrared. You see the infrared light taken with UV, which is consistent with the. So now the question is the origin of this optical flickering, because we observe an optical here, and we see that it's a very complex region because we have a contribution from the accretion disk.
Yes, sir. Can you come back to the if this is your flux of photons, what is the noise that you would expect?
It's a square root of okay?
It's a complex region because of the contribution of the disk.
Yeah, so here the optical we observe here there is a contribution from the disk. Apparently there is a contribution from the jet which seems to extend up to the optical, maybe the UV. And also if you extrapolate the hard X-ray, you end up somewhere here, so you also may have a contribution from the hot plasma here. So it is difficult to disentangle the location where this optical flickering is produced.
So what radius do you expect the disk contribution to
be? It's very far, very far away.
Yeah. And then how can it be so quickly back in the past?
Okay, so I'm coming to that.
Okay.
So let's consider the case of the disc. It's in this region you see the outer part of the disc in more than thousands of shots right there.
Okay.
So you don't expect to have a strong variability intrinsic to the disk, but you could have reprocessing of the X-rays on the outer part of the disk.
Yeah.
And then you would expect the optical due to reprocessing to vary on similar time scale of the X-ray.
So what is the, say, 1,000
watts per second? It's about half a second.
Why did you use ultraviolet instead of some optical stuff
that
you did with ultraviolet?
Sorry?
What did you gain by doing UV observations
with the HST? It's not me. It's just I was showing this is done by Hans. Okay. And they observed with HST. And what you gain is that you have a broader band. I mean, you can see the variability from the UV to the optical. And they also use the nuclear data to have been correct. So to show that this phenomenon acts on different wavelengths.
Absolutely.
But the resolution is lower with the HST data than with optima, of course.
Okay. So you're just not showing
the
optical.
That's okay. What's the inferred accretion rate? This is if you just look at the solid luminosity, it's 10^-3. But if the source is relatively inefficient, then it might be. Okay, so let's assume that what you see in the variability we observe is due to the processing. Then we have two problems, because the optical seems to vary on shorter time scale than X-ray. This is can be shown here from the autocorrelation function of the X-ray and the optical autocorrelation. We correlate the light curves with itself plus shifted by some light that is shown by the x-axis, and more or less the broadness of this peak shows the average time scale of the fluctuation in the signal, and we see that the optical is much narrower, significantly narrower than the x-ray. While if you are reprocessing, you expect the optical to vary at least on the similar time scale of the x-ray. So this is a problem for reprocessing. And now, if you compute the cross-correlation function between the optical and the X-ray, you get this. So you do the same thing, you correlate the X-ray light curve with the optical shifted by some light here, which is shown in X axis. And more or less these curves can be considered as the response of the optical to an X-ray flare that we pick at zero light. So you have a very fast response at positive light, with a peak here that is delayed by about half a second, and then a slow decay in the optical. So this part of the cross-correlation function will be consistent with reprocessing. On the other hand, you see that at negative light, there is some this kind of dip here. It seems that the optical dips a few seconds before the peak in the X-ray. And this would suggest that the optical knows about what will happen in the X-ray a few seconds later. And for this reason, this dip was called by Kandor et al., who discovered this, it was called a precognition dip. So this feature rule out all kind of model where the variability is driven by the X-rays, and then propagates to the optical. So the reprocessing model seems to be ruled out. Another possibility is to have some kind of synchrotron emission in the corona itself. Since you have a hot electrons and probably magnetized plasma, it is possible that this electron will produce a self-absorbed synchrotron. However, the optical luminosity requires a size of the emitting region that will be of a few thousand shots radii, which is a bit larger compared to what is inferred from the measurement of the inner disk radius, which was a few hundred shots radii. And also there is a problem to reproduce the spectrum, because the spectrum of self-absorbed synchrotron with a given temperature is very narrow, and it is a sharp peak. And here you have to explain first variability from the infrared to the UV, and you also have to explain the shape of the spectrum, which is more, much more like a power law here. And also, as the spectrum seems to be the continuation from the jet, it seems more natural to assume that the variability is due to the proton emission in the jet. However, so synchrotron emission in the jet, but how do you then explain the correlation between the X-ray and the optical? So the simplest model that comes to mind is to say that, well, you have some fluctuation or some blob of material that is ejected and that travels from the X-rays to the optical photosphere, and then you, you see it, and then you explain the lag that is in the cross correlation. However, this kind of model runs into the same problems as the reprocessing models, because you have shorter time scale of variability in the optical, and also you have to explain why the optical dips before the X-rays. So it is not as simple as that. And also, if you investigate more in detail the correlation, you find some very intriguing features. For instance, here I computed the cross-correlation function on different scales. You filter the light first to keep only the fluctuation of a given time scale before computing the cross-correlation. So it is for time scale ranging from 3 milliseconds to 0.1 seconds, 0.1 seconds to 1 second, 1 second to 10 seconds, 10 seconds to 100 seconds. And in all plots, you see the same structure with a dip and a flare a positive lag. But what is interesting here is that maybe you cannot see the scale here, but here this is 100 seconds, here this is 10 seconds, here this is 1 second, and this is a tenth of seconds. So it looks like there is some kind of scale invariance in the correlation. So the optical, the lag of the optical depends on the time scale. So to better understand the dependence on time scale, you can use Fourier analysis, which is more appropriate. You can compute the power spectrum in the X-rays, which is typical of the power spectra that are observed in the hot states, with about band-limited noise. You see the power spectrum in the optical, which confirms that the optical tends to vary on shorter time scales. And this is the coherence spectrum, which shows the degree of linear correlation between the two light curves as a function of the Fourier frequency. And you show here, this shows that most of the correlation occurs for fluctuation ranging from 1 second to 10 seconds. And then, probably most interesting, you can plot the phase lag, the optical phase lag, which is related to the time lag to this formula. And you see that this phase lag depends on the time scale, but in the range of time scale where most of the correlation occurs, this phase lag is close to pi over 2. And when you have two time series with a phase lag of pi over 2, this means that there is some kind of differential relation between the two light curves. So in our case, we can write this relation as by saying that the optical is somewhat related to the time derivative of the X-rays. And you can investigate this more directly by looking directly into the light curves. So here we selected spikes in the optical light curves, and then you pile up all these spikes in the optical, and you average them, and you do the same thing with the corresponding pieces of light curve in the X-rays. And what you see is that to an optical spike, on average, corresponds a sharp decay in the X-ray light curve. And you can do the same thing with a dip in the optical light curve, and you say that you have a fast rise in the X-ray light curve at the same time. So this will be consistent with the fact that the optical is related to the time derivative of the X-ray. So the conclusion of all this is that, for me, the most likely hypothesis is that the optical flickering comes to the jet, but we need some kind of more complex jet discovery to understand this. And to illustrate the possible jet discovery model, we propose a very simple phenomenological model in which the jet and the disk are coupled through a common energy reservoir. So you can understand this model with this simple analog, where you have a tank that is filled with water, and you have several pipes on this tank, one input pipe, a big pipe that represents the flow into the jet, and a small pipe that represents the flow into the Higgs waves. So at, in the steady state, there is an equilibrium and the energy level in the tank is at some height. Now if you open more the jet cap, then the jet power will increase, the level will decrease, and the X-ray power will decrease. On the other hand, if you, you close a little bit more the jet cap, then the height increase and the X-ray power increase as well. And then we assume that all the taps are controlled by some random process, and as I will show you, we can reproduce the properties of the light curve like this. So in practice, how do you do? You just write the time-dependent equation of the system, so you write that the time variation of the energy in the reservoir is what you inject, minus what goes into the jets, minus what goes into the X-rays. You write the jet power in terms of the dissipation rate into the jet, which is this dissipation rate means how much you open the tap or close it. And then you choose some, you impose independent random fluctuation for Pi, Kj, Kx, and then you solve the equation for E. And then you just have to generate the X-ray and the optical light curve by assuming that the X-ray light curve observes proportional to Px. And the optical is Pj, a time lag to account for the delay from the disk to the optical photosphere.
And you take a fixed number for that?
Yes. That is inferred from the inferred size of the optical emission. But it has very little effect on the result anyway. So the main parameters of the model are the dissipation time of the energy reservoir, means the response time of the reservoir, which is given by the average of the dissipation rate in the X-ray in the jet, and the fraction of the power that is dissipated into the X-ray, Fx. And then you can play with the parameters, and you can find a solution to all the problems. So here, we impose this fluctuation for the input energy, the jet dissipation rate, and the X-ray dissipation rate. And here are the power spectrum of the imposed fluctuation to the system, and the solution for the X-ray light curve and the optical light curves. And then you can compute the autocorrelation of this light curve, and you find that the optical is narrower than the X-rays. You can compute the cross correlation, and you find that you have a dip and you have a lag.
So that dip just means that after the optical flares, when you have a drop in X-ray below, then the usual continuum, is that the sequence of events? But you have a flare in the X-ray, then you have the optical, then you kind of dip in the X-ray again? What causes that?
The wrong question. It's simply that when you're flared to the X-ray, you start by when you take energy, the power in the X-ray, and then you drag the energy reservoir, and you create deep in the optical.
You're giving the explanation. Knowledge of this?
Yeah, that's
because this group you're probably used to thinking in these terms, but some people.
It's simply,
what does it mean?
I think it's simply the fact. It reflects the fact that the other property that we've seen in the light curve, that the optical is related to the minus the time derivative of the X-ray. So when the X-ray starts rising here, the optical decreases. And when the X-ray decays, then the optical...
Now is that in terms of the reservoir? The reservoir height is the optical emission?
No, it is the energy.
Yeah,
and the optical emission is proportional to...
And the optical emission is what...
Okay, so you increase the optical emission a little bit later, you see the X-ray is gone. Or you should decrease the optical emission.
I think so, yeah, right?
Yes, if you...
Exactly.
If you... Yes, if you...
Decrease the optimization.
Similar phenomenon in solar spires.
It's a normal direction. In solar spires, and it is explained, simple choice. The flux of hard X-rays is proportional to the time derivative of the soft X-rays. With the plus sign. And the reason for that is that the hard X-rays, so the distance of the derivative, the hard X-rays produced instantly becomes strong by the synthesis of the connection. In the corona, the accelerated particles travel along the field line, go to the photosphere, and they, so energetic electrons go into the photosphere, they produce hard X-rays, that's how the condition sort of instantly. But that leads to a lot of heating of these two points, and the plasma is evaporated and the field is loops, post-square loops, and they continue to emit soft X-rays for a long time. So the amount of soft X-ray flux is proportional to the sort of the integral of the energy that was put into the two things over time.
What do we know about variability in magnetic stars, or more strongly magnetic stars in the sun? Is there anything like this?
And this phenomenon actually has a name. In solar flares, it has a name.
What does it mean?
That it's effect. You perhaps, I think, remember some button.
Siphon flutes? The flow circles, huh?
The name for what?
For the observational fact that the flux of let's see, hard X-ray is proportional to the time derivative. But here it's, first of all, it's the opposite. And secondly, the minus sign.
And does it actually explain your self-similarity with the time scale invariance, approximate invariance?
Yes.
How does that work?
Yes. Because you have the same, more or less, the optical response in the same way to, or whatever the time scale in which you switch on and off your paths, you more or less have the same response.
Right, but if you're filling times, this is a definite filling time scale with, associated with the average properties, and that filling time scale would be, this is in your case, half a second?
Yes.
But then if you switch it on say milliseconds time scale, you're
actually
very small.
Yeah, but the most of the phenomena we observe, the correlation happens between 1 and 10 seconds. So,
yeah, except 1 you need to keep yourself.
You have to get the mic.
Something like this, if you look at this region more closely, then the observations are observations, so this. But this is maybe 1.5 seconds or so. The change in slope.
But this is a matter of the world.
But because this reservoir has this integrating property. You know, switch something on and after a little bit of time it starts changing. but you already see things very happening in very short time.
Can I ask you just about the X-ray? If you don't put the optical in there, this is like, if it goes up, does it tend to be followed by a dip, or maybe with an M, I suppose? I suppose it's, so it's autocorrelation function, so probably so fuzzy something as well.
No,
about the X-ray?
About the X-ray, it's about...
Yeah, so X-ray. If you were to put it in itself, what does it look like?
It's pretty much symmetric.
It's here, it's super close.
Oh, that's what that is, okay. Okay, so it's symmetric, okay, so...
So, you can know the parameter, we have to make the number works, we have to take half x, the fraction, and put into the power and put into it straight to 0.1, which is quite low. And this means that in this case, the jet dominates the over the x-ray. So now I will discuss more in details what are the constraints that we have on the parameters from the observation, and also as you probably noted, there is at the moment there is absolutely no physics in the model. There is no tank with water in KVNUMA, but there are several components in the equation field that could play a similar role. For instance, the material in the disk are reservoir of gravitational energy and angular momentum. If you have a two temperature accretion flow, then you have hot ions which contains a lot of energy that can be used to power up with the X-rays. And also the energy could be stored in the form of electromagnetic energy. So to be more specific, we try to consider a very simple and naive scenario in which the magnetic field itself is the reservoir.
Are you going to tell us how many parameters there are in this model?
Sorry?
How many parameters are there in the model?
There are the dissipation, there are the dissipation speed, there is the fraction of the power into the X-ray, so these are the two main parameters, and then you have to define the time scale or the power spectrum of the two quantities that you that are input, the two expectations that you impose to the system. But I will discuss this later.
Can I so the X-rays are still coming from condensation, is that the idea?
Yeah.
In a corona, not from the jet. But
yes.
And are there any spectral variations with any correlations or anti-correlations between X-ray spectral index and X-ray flux?
The spectrum is softer and the flux is larger.
The flux is larger. It's soft.
It's not very, very strong.
Yeah.
And it's very... So here, but actually the idea of the energy reservoir is very old. It comes from when the people realized that if you compute the energy content of the thermal electrons in the corona, it is very, very low compared to the luminosity observed. And the cooling time of the electron is extremely short. So they have to be connected to some kind of energy reservoir where a lot of energy, accretion energy is stored before being transmitted to the electrons. And what was proposed is that it is a magnetic field in a magnetically dominated corona where you have some kind of field amplification, for instance, to the surface, the energy is stored in the corona and then dissipates, possibly through the connection. And then you can write the X-ray power in this term, like the dissipation speed of the field over the size of the emitting region times the energy. And then you relate the dissipation rate in the X-ray to physical parameters. Then if you consider the jet, which is related by the polynomial component of the magnetic field, if you look in the literature, you can find formula of this type to approximate the jet power and the polyvalent component, the area of the disk that is shredded by the field, and the rotational velocity in the disk. And then, if it is simplified to the dynamic processes, the polyvalent component is limited by the scale height of the flow, and as a rough approximation, we can say that the photographic field, say like a shape of a C times the magnetic field. And then you end up with this simple formula, which drives in terms of this parameter times the energy, and then you have an expression for the jet dissipation rate in terms of the physical parameter of the models. And then what you can do is relate this physical parameter to the parameters of the time-dependent model that you have, FX and TDS. And then you get constraints on the physical parameters of the flow, and it is probably that chance, but we find that all these constraints are very reasonable. We find scale heights of 0.20, and if it's about 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7, depending on the geometry we consider. In the case of the corona, we have the aspect ratio that is around 1 unity, which is exactly what we need to produce the shape of the exosection. So there is no problem on this one, but we should believe this. This one. I used very simple estimate of the X-ray power and the jet power. It relates the dissipation rate, the average dissipation rates, to some physical parameters. And then
it's not your storage reservoir, is it?
Sorry?
Where's your storage reservoir? And this is all just instantaneous energy balances. Where's the reservoir in this picture?
No, this we have to consider only the dissipation, average volume for the jet.
Yeah.
This is an average over time and over the disk, over everything. It's very rough approximation. And we say that this average is equal to the average of this.
I find it a bit hard to believe that you can have, you say, half a second or so of filling the reservoir. So this reservoir has to be able to power the jet and everything for half a second. So that's the energy you have to have in there. Is that so?
No, it's not. It's the energy in the reservoir.
Yeah, I was just wondering, it seems to me a bit like a large amount of energy. Say, half a second of accretion is a large amount of energy. Can you really store that in the magnetic field there?
Yeah, I mean, this is what I showed here, that the magnetic field is reasonable.
Yeah, but this is all based on instantaneous energy balance, or
no? It's an average. It's a fine average. And if you want to produce the luminosity that I observe, then on average, not on a fluctuation of a second, but 10 to the 36 hertz per second, then you need the.
In other words, with 3 10 to the 6 hours in a volume of 100 Schwarzschild radii, you have enough energy to power the jet for half a second.
Yeah.
Wouldn't
this come from something?
It's 3 million
cows. Right?
And the magnetic field is 3 million
cows? Yes. This comes from simply the fact that you have these expressions and then you take FX and these. The values that
have
come from.
So the field has to be this big to produce.
Mm-hmm.
So where does this come from? From the requirement that it explains observations or from some underlying theory?
No, from the requirements that from the parameters of the time-dependent model.
Is it realistic to produce such a large field?
No, yes, it's close to what you expect. I mean, this is close to what is expected from the partition argument and so on.
Yeah.
It's 10 to the minus 5, I'm sorry. It's a mistake here. It's going to be minus.
That's pretty fast.
No, it's very slow.
We have seen a lot of numbers here. What is Rx out? Rx is.
Rx is the size of the emitting, of the X-ray emitting region, or of the region in the corona.
Okay, so this so where does this number come from? The 2 times 10 to the 5 minus 5?
Well,
yeah. Okay, so for a number actually, where does it come from? Just some random number
there. Do you agree with, this is the... The number, there are only two numbers here. Is this one, fx open one.
So what is fx?
Fx is the fraction of the total power that is put into the disk.
Okay.
And this is the dissipation, what we call the dissipation time of the
oh, it's time, it's in seconds. Okay.
So you have this. This is this component to reproduce the data. Then you inject this value here and here. And then you see what kind of constraint you can have on this polystyrene. Knowing that the radius of the configuration is about 100
degrees. Yeah, can you back that a little bit and give us a physical explanation of the two constraints up at the top?
Now, this is basically the dissipation. This is the dissipation rate in the X-rays. This effect over here. And this is the dissipation rate into the jet. And I write that the dissipation rate into the jet is equal to what is given by the expression I had before. Yeah. This is this. This is exactly the same thing that I will write here. So I just say, this is equal to this, on average. This is equal to this, on average. But this, I know it from the time-dependent model.
So what is R sub C?
R C is the radius below which you have the jet and the corona.
So it's the outer?
The outer radius, the inner radius of the disk.
And the BP distributions were also in this at the same distance? Or?
Yes, it's an average.
You mean the average or the outer range?
You use an integral, isn't it?
Yes, in principle, it should be an integral. The outer range is the order of magnitude of thinness. You should not try to.
Well, you can do the magnitude of disk.
It could depend on the geometry and so on.
I mean, the power of the jet, maybe it's the innermost part of the disk or whatever,
these large distances. Yeah, but this is why I scaled with this RC here. And if you want, you can change the view of RC. So, this is what happens.
You see, but let us take you back only to component of finite field. Mm-hmm. And the Balloido component isn't required by MRI.
Yes, in this scenario, yes.
And that's a large scale field can be defined by MRI. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Yes, in some sense.
Oh. Is that what I expected?
Mm-hmm. I think it's
different. I think working across each one of these equations is a question.
What's interesting is this really observation that there's this time dependent, this time derivative kind of relation. I think it's good to have some reservoir model like this is sort of a natural outcome of it, but I don't know. I would go further than that, I'm not too sure. Because the magnetic field, it's not clear how much of the magnetic field is really available for, and whether that's a really good reservoir to talk about. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in jet, magnetic field is only a sort of what you call it, not a catalyst, but a conduit for the energy flux. It doesn't change itself. So if the energy that comes out in a jet, if you wait long enough, can be many orders of magnitude larger than the energy you have in the magnetic field. Mm-hmm. So there's not a very direct relation between energy and magnetic field and what comes out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's a
for example.
Yeah.
If the point eliminate the jet, then
we should give Julian a chance to finish his talk.
Yes.
We're already late. So.
Okay, then. So Now I would like to discuss what are the constraints of the different parameters of the models from cubic and observations. And we tried many different simulations, and we find that there are two conditions if you want more or less to produce the observed features. The first one is that the jet activity should be responsible for most of the survivability, most of the dissipation in the jet dissipation changes a lot and controls the fluctuation of the energy reservoir. And the second condition that's important is that the jet dominates over the energetic output of the system. It means that the jet power has to be at least a few times more than the X-ray power if you want this model to work. And this can be understood using the analytical arguments if you revise the time-dependent equation for the reservoir. You see that it is in this form, and if you want the condition optical proportional to value of the space to be 35, it means that these terms should be either negligible or slowly variable, and so that this term only dominates. And if you write this equation, it's not straightforward, but you find that the 1 to 10 second probability is given by the jet dissipation rate, and second, that the jet dominates over the X-ray. So this is first to have this condition verified. So I will discuss first the fact that the variability of the jet dominates the variability of the system. So here you see the simulation, you see that the jet, the fluctuation that enters the jet dissipation rate and the dissipation, the fluctuation of the X-ray dissipation rate. And you see that indeed we have to low 1 second the fluctuation of the jet dissipation rate to make the systems.
Is this power per log hertz?
Yes, it's frequency times power.
Okay.
And also we have to have variability on a shorter time scale than the dissipation rate of the jet. So the fluctuation dissipation rate went from 0.1 second to 1 second. This corresponds to dynamical time scale, and from 10 to 100 to radii. And this is consistent with the X-ray production in the Hertz phase as a local process. On the other hand, the fluctuation of the jet dissipation range went to up down to 1 order on magnitude longer time scale. So this is consistent with the idea that produce a jet, you need to produce a large-scale coherent structure that takes more time to destroy. And what's interesting is that here is the power spectrum of the X-rays, and you see that it doesn't look like the power spectrum of the dissipation rate in the X-rays. This is because it looks more like the dissipation of the jet, because the jet modulates the fluctuation of the jet dissipation rate, drains the reservoir in the reservoir, and this modulates the X-ray emission. So the jet activity modulates the X-ray emission, and this has an interesting observational consequences, is that if you take the average of a certain flux level and measure the average amplitude of variability, you find a correlation between the flux and the element that is observed in this source as well as in many other black hole binaries in the Hertz. Now what we can check is that the second condition for the model to work is that the jet has to dominate. So it's reasonable that the jet dominates from the data we have. If you measure the observed jet and its frame luminosities, and assume that the jet power is the same time as its ray power, then you infer a relative efficiency for the jet, which is around 1%, which is low, and which is not unreasonable compared to what is expected from model of jet dissipations. And now there is another interesting thing that in KDU map you can usually infer the accretion rate, the mass accretion rate directly from the fits of the thermal disk component. And you find that in the case of a hot disk in a disk, you find mass accretion rates that are from 10 to 200 times the observed X-ray luminosity. So the source is relatively inefficient, and there is enough accretion power to allow for that dominating source. It is not clear, of course, if all the missing energy goes into the jet or if it's detected in the hole, but it is possible that it goes into the jet.
How do you infer the accretion rate? That's from the fit, you say, to the
less
disk second. But you, part of that is the optical to EUV, which is known to be this very strongly variable component, which is therefore not a disk.
EUV, strongly variable?
Well,
no,
I don't know, but...
No, it's not the EUV, I mean, it's from the optical to the extreme EUV.
Yeah. Exactly.
And the extreme EUV, we don't know.
We don't know, so you assume that...
And the optical is like a element of 10%, so we are not at 10%, we're not doing things at 10% yet. Accuracy.
Well, with that
10%. Well, there is a lot of subjectivity on the measurement of the radius, and this can change the things a lot, but we are
so saying the optical emission is still 90% risk?
I don't know, maybe it's half, it's half, I don't know exactly. Because you would have to do the detailed fit of the jet and, you
know.
You can have the optical flex dominated by the disk, but the optical variability dominated by the jet.
Yeah, okay. With the spectrum of this object, the optical spectrum didn't look anything like typical advances, this enormously strong blue continuum, but the typical reprocessing lines are very weak and so on, so there wasn't really much of a disk spectrum there at all.
I think that we fitted it with a disk and other platform and people fitted with a disk and we found reasonable things. So.
So
of course you can say it's not a disk.
No, I mean, because if you have this interesting optical component, it does all these interesting things. So you don't see reprocessing.
Okay. So the conclusion was that there is no problem of energy budget to produce a strong jet. And what is interesting, I come back to the comment of jet dominated states. That as I told you, this the transition from jet dominated to jet dominated depends upon unknown parameters here. And this author took a conservative value and put the condition here at about 10 to minus 7 Newton. But actually, if in the minima the jet power is as strong as we say, then the transition would occur at about 10% of the Newton, which means above the transition to the solid state. And the consequence would be that all the outside sources would be jet dominated in this case. Okay, so conclusion is that we believe that we observed evidence for coupling between accretion and ejection processes in very short time scale using optical and photometric. And from a model which can explain at least qualitatively this the complicated correlation of the observed, and this model requires that the jet power dominates over the X-rays, and this is possibly true for all our X-ray or outstate sources. Okay, thank you.